Hello, guys.
I guess we are 8 minutes after our beginning, so to save our time and perhaps our energy, we'll begin, or in our modern language, we'll kick off this this meeting or workshop. So before I will ask to pray with me, I would like to very welcome and sincerely introduce to all of you who doesn't know yet and who does anyway, Sister Nula, who is with us, who will be main speaker to us today. Thank you to be with us. And be gentle. She has a little bit of issue with her voice, so maybe everything will be a little bit, you know, smoother as we think. And also, I would like to introduce to those who doesn't know yet, Mr. Ron Chisholm, our helper and parishioner and the end lawyer around our town. So if you have after our meeting some legal questions about many things, you can ask him to set up some time. So now, as I mentioned at your beginning, in the first page, when you open your booklet, it's a prayer to Saint Joseph. Let us begin with invoke our Heavenly Father and His Son and Holy Spirit to be with us. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. The Lord be with you. And let us pray all together. O Saint Joseph, whose protection is so great, so strong, so prompt before the throne of God, I place in you all my interests and desires. O Saint Joseph, to assist me by your powerful intercession, and obtain for me from your divine Son all spiritual blessings through Jesus Christ our Lord, so that having engaged here below your heavenly power, I may offer my thanksgiving and homage to thee, most loving of fathers. O Saint Joseph, I never weary contemplating you and Jesus asleep in your arms. I dare not approach while he was in your heart. Press him in my name and kiss his forehead for me, and ask him to return the kiss and I draw my deep breath. O Saint Joseph, patron of dying souls, pray for me. Amen. Okay.
It's yours. That's it.
Lozenges at the ready. First thing I want us to do, sorry, that's focused that way, it's a, is to say a prayer to Saint Blaise. You do all remember, right, Father? Blaise is the patron when we have our throats blessed of conditions of the throat. I mean, I have had terrible cold flu-like symptoms, but with a persisting laryngitis that is kind of worrisome. I'm also only 2.5 months from a recurrence of breast surgery, so part of my inability to recover is my general health status. But I was going to be here for these folks no matter what, and just please God that I can get through the reflection and help initiate this, and you help me in a project that now, in the diocese as a whole, me personally and Immaculate Conception Truro is engaged in. So, if you would, Saint Blaise, patron of those with diseases of the throat, please pray for me that I can, in fact, conclude this well through your inspiration and the power of the Holy Spirit. Thank you. Okay, wait now. So you realize I have to get the water ready here if I start to choke. It's like getting a resuscitation team in order. Okay, so it's got familiar rings to it. I'll eat that if I have an episode that won't stop. So we're going to talk today And here I'm flashing up your bulletin. I said to Father Darius and to Michael and, of course, my good pal Eleanor and Betty and the members of the team, you're helping me do something that we all think is going to be an advantage, not just in practical decision-making in the current circumstances of our secular society, but in helping people understand our spiritual and moral tradition about medical decisions, not just for dying, but for all medical decisions. You need to know this idea I had mentioned in a lecture in Antigonish for the then Bishop Dunn of Antigonish, who of course is now our coadjutor and will be our bishop next December. And Bishop Dunn came and said to me, "You know, Nuala, this idea of thinking of advanced care planning for health decisions in this technological world in which we live, with the pressures of medically assisted death having become normal, and with so much Catholic confusion about what the church does actually teach, folks who are clueless, in fact, they're heretical in what they thought the church has required. Church has a very wonderful, prudent tradition, and I'll show you a couple of things." So Bishop Ryan said, this was 2.5 years ago, "Do you think you could help me work up something?" And so I began to draft up something. But I also have a brand new book on the clergy abuse crisis coming out next Thursday. And so that preoccupied me. And this got put on hold until we started to work in the Ministry of Care and Companionship Committee for our Archdiocese, and with particular attention to Eleanor talking to me about your parish and work that you folks have been doing. So this is what I want you to understand is happening, because this is not a usual practice in the church. We're going to take an idea that started in one diocese, kind of been worked through at a diocesan level in another one, and begin to try to use it as a tool for spiritual growth as well as practical decision making with real live people. And each time we do that, test out, improve, make the questions, make the explanations more clear and more appropriate. So you folks here in Immaculate Conception, you're now my big test case. So the little booklet that has been published by the team, thank you. Not only are we going to use it here, but I'm going to be taking this to a big talk in Manitoba for the Catholic Health Association of Manitoba and the Grey Nuns, October 11th, and I'm going to be telling them this version now has been adapted by the Parish of the Immaculate Conception in Truro. So we're going to present this to you as a tool, but this is not a tool, this is not a catechism. We're not setting down all the questions and all the answers even before you know what the question is that you want to ask. This is a guide to decision making in the Catholic spiritual and moral tradition in the context of a technologically driven society that believes in technology even to alleviate suffering, a secular society that rejects the worldview, and the rapid normalization of medically assisted death in this country. so that even 80% of polled Canadians in Canada think medically assisted suicide and euthanasia are just fine. The issue here now is we're going to test this out, and I have to say, Father Darius is, there he is over there. I said to him, man, you're doing something right, boy. I did say it. I told him he was a good boy. I'm 75. I can tell him he's a good boy. We got over 65 people here. This is amazing. Now, reflect as I go through the session now, because I'm going to give you a compacted backgrounder with some definitions and church teaching. Then we're going to have a little break. And then we're going to look at using all of the information I gave you to answer the questions we're suggesting you have to entertain when you're making decisions, not just for end of life. The way you make decisions for major surgery that's not life-threatening has an effect on the way you make decisions at end of life. Some of you are risk adverse. Some of you are bungee jumpers. Some of you need lots of information. So what we're going to do then is we're going to take the experience, give a summary of where we are with all of this, and in part two, you'll have time to begin to talk together about in what way the questions that we have posited give you help in doing two things: practical planning for serious healthcare decisions and dying, and in fact have informed your faith. So there's going to be kind of a twofer here. So if you don't have a seat buckle, just get yourself firmly in the seat, because we're going to move. So we live in a world that really does believe that there's a technological fix for everything. Our images of medicine and healthcare are very much images that from the television, right? The ER, the cardiac arrest team, stand back, zap them, everybody turn it up, everybody. I mean, it's very active and portrayed definitely by the media as if once the resuscitation occurs, you're sitting up at the end of the half-hour show ready to continue the trip to Florida. Now, this is important. Begin to think of how your mind, your public imagination around healthcare has been affected by, please understand, I'm a doctor. I'm a professor of medicine. I mean, when we do good stuff, I love it. But I also know what we can't do. And I also know what happens when technology, in fact, has a negative side effect, not a cure. So the fragility of healthcare is important, but people do have a tendency to think of it. You have a problem, great, you go high technology, science, imagery, and now they don't even have to cut your belly open. When you have a mastectomy, I assure you they do cut you open. Other surgery, they have this little snaky thing goes in. I mean, it's like amazing. So instead of a scar that 30 years ago would have been this big in abdominal surgery, you got this little tiny hole. So amazing things have happened. But the thing I want you to think of is that our imagination about healthcare is being captured by a belief that medicine can fix everything. Now I want you to imagine, very rarely in Catholic reflection, evangelization and catechesis, do we actually ask people just to sit and imagine. Some of you who know my book, Rediscovering the Art of Dying, really that's about imagining. It's imagining Jesus' experience from Gethsemane until the resurrection. Just sit in, what do we know about, imagine, see him. It's, by the way, the Ignatian approach, right, where you put yourself with Jesus. You're not just watching him. You're trying to enter into Jesus' experience. So this is a test of imagination. Now, I will observe, as I observe every time I talk about it, end-of-life care or advanced care planning, that the population in this room, average age, is above Jack Benny's 39. You, if you'd like to leave now.
I have to go to confession now.
But what I'm saying, pay attention to, and thank God there are a couple of younger folks here, because this is really problematic when we have young people who are not thinking this way. Just hold the phone. We're just recognizing. Imagine that you have been in a car accident and are in the hospital emergency department or the recovery room. So you're either in a car accident and you're in the ER trying to sort out what happened. Or you're in the recovery room where you're waiting for the surgeon to tell you if she got it all. So one, an urgent situation, unexpected. The other one, you knew you were going to have the surgery. Right, now you're waiting to hear what happened. What happened? How will you, have you, do you face medical decisions? What are your personal factors in decision making in general? The way you buy your house or sell your house or move to a retirement community, the decisional process is not going to be very different than what it is in health. Risk taker, risk avoidant, need information, don't need much information, need control, don't need control. Begin to think in general about in this situation. Especially, what happens if what message comes to you from the ER physicians or the surgeon is going to require big technological intervention? Are you somebody who says, sure, I'll go to the Mayo Clinic and let them do this experimental surgery, take out my gut and replace my gut with somebody else's gut, go for it? Or are you somebody who says, oh, you got to be kidding. You got to be kidding. You got to put tubes how do you relate to technology? And by the way, I would not now want to bet on the number in this room who are bionic elders. But if I could please have a show of hands. Bionic elders. Thank you. He wasn't even acknowledging it. Hips, knees, joints. Pacemakers, defibrillators. No. Begin to think of them. There are all kinds of things we absolutely have better lives about because of technology. I'm not disputing that. I was a chief of two children's hospitals. When medicine does good, it does good. Whoops. Oh, I hit that. But in that situation, in addition to your personal decisional factors, does your faith and church teaching play a role? The last time you were in the ER for yourself or a loved one, was church teaching, spiritual teaching, moral teaching coming anywhere into your thought? Think of that. Now imagine that you're unconscious from the car accident. You went in the ER and you're still unconscious. And there are decisions to be made. Or you're now in post-op recovery, but because of an adverse event during the surgery, you're not waking up. And there are decisions to be made. Who will decide for you in the circumstances when you cannot decide for yourself? And how will they be prepared? And you're going to see from the church perspective, if we have confusion among many middle-aged elderly who received some formation from the church, if your 38-year-old son has never been to church in 20 years, and you've never talked about faith with him, how is he going to be able to do his job, which is to speak for you, if you don't prepare? All right. Am I making sense? All right, so let's see then if you can let me do an overview of important background thoughts. I don't care about that little fellow. Sorry. I'm going to do a review, and Father Darius and Eleanor and Betty, they all knew that I'm going to start where I always start, with the death of St. Joseph. Right. So everyone here knows, I never saw that prayer. It's obviously a nostalgic one from somewhere, you know, it's not a more recent one, but it's lovely. And this is what you need to understand. Saint Joseph is the patron of a good death in the Catholic tradition. We have no scriptural images on the death of Joseph. In fact, poor Joseph, he gets such a poor job in the scriptures that when I get up there, I am going to go to those apostles and say, "You, the evangelists, what did he ever do to you?" His yes to take care of Mary and Jesus was almost as important as hers, saying yes to the Holy Spirit. Though what we don't know details, this is the piety that it grew up early in the life of the church. And many of you who've heard me lecture before have seen this one. And we don't have time because we have so much stuff to go through today, but let me just show you this. I want you, quietly now, to look at the photo of the ancient painting, and in your own mind and heart, what do you see that would be a feature, that for you would be a feature of a good death? Like, what do you see modeled here? Just quietly for a second. Maybe we'll. Okay. Well, because I need to have one or two of you. Go ahead, loud. Da da. Jesus is surrounded by what I call his intimate others. I don't use family anymore, because too many persons, especially too many elders, who are seriously ill and dying, it's not their family members that are supporting them. It's not the family members that are. This is an important ministry consideration. But the most important thing that you've named here is Everyone would have this sense that the worst thing that could happen to you is to die alone. I did 34 years of pediatric palliative care. Don't tell me about tough deaths. I've done adult ethics and palliative care, but the first thing that we see is that he's surrounded by his loved ones. Let's give anybody one more observation that's really hot. Well, this is an interesting, because you just, the two answers are the two answers I get all the time, and they're not actually the same. So what we see is, so that he's surrounded by his loved ones. Usually the next thing that people notice is Jesus is holding Joseph's hand. Joseph isn't holding Jesus' hand. This is the son holding on to his earthly father. Okay? And Joseph, it's interesting because people, it's not clear whether or not Joseph is looking at his son because he's praying or because he's his son, his earthly son, his stepson. What we do know is that the attitude, the atmosphere that you've all captured is that it is a scene of great peace. This is Joseph, the just man, surrounded by his loved ones, dying at home, by the way, when it was possible to do so. Who in fact, it's a scene of sadness, but he's ready to go to God. Now, this is very interesting because you might say, Nuala, first of all, we have no history for that. Second, that's 2,200 years ago. What has that got to do with dying in the brand new fancy schmancy Truro Hospital or IWK or wherever? Well, this is interesting because up until the 1980s, when people identified for themselves and their loved ones, usually from having had an experience of a loved one dying. So most of you are of an age that you have had a loved one die. Please God, some of you have had good deaths, though some of you may have had very difficult deaths. But when people identify up until the era where medically assisted death became the norm, in the beginning of technology, the ventilator, the cardiopulmonary resuscitation, all those new advances, the characteristics were non-abandonment and continuity of care. To move to the intentional goals of palliative care at end of life is not euthanasia. But it also isn't, and then I've said to medical students, I'll haunt you if I ever hear you say this to a patient. There's nothing more we can do. Now we'll consult palliative care. You hear them say that to a patient, and you know, even if I'm on my deathbed, you call me. What a horrible thing to say. A goal of medicine directed towards end of life. And symptom control is one of the three historic goals of medicine. Cure was actually always only expected in our time. Even now, most of medicine is improvement. But we need now to up the ante. If there's one thing that you're going to get one chance at, it's dying. So care of dying should be good. So this is interesting. Non-abandonment, continuity of care, avoidance of unwanted technological intervention, respectful communication, and then completion of what we call last things. And actually, some of the most interesting writing on this comes from two of my Jewish colleagues, Ira Bayak, who's just a sweetie pie, just a palliative care doc from Manitoba, worked at St. Boniface for years, Ira puts it this way. Think of for yourself, and this will be relevant when you're going through the document. If you were told, you happened to be in front of me, and you didn't fess up that you were a bionic man, so now you're getting it. What's your name, dear?
Ralph
Campbell. Hi, Ralph. You have to reveal everything. Ralph, if in fact, God forbid, I don't want this to happen. You were told later on this afternoon that in all likelihood, though remember, I could get killed on the way home in the car. I'm a pediatrician. Dying at 2 means you're older than if you're 89 and you got 10 more years to go. I live in the retirement center with the Sisters of Charity of Halifax. 98 is young. But if in fact you were told, in all likelihood, with everything that they've discussed, your death is probably closer, not further away. That we've done everything we can. We think now, we're thinking maybe in terms of days to or weeks, maybe weeks to months, but we're not talking months to years. You now have an opportunity to be aware of this. And Ira Byock would ask you, so if you had that, what are the things that you would immediately, so you go to bed, you sob, you hope that you get love and affection, even though you didn't fit, so she's going to be there for you. What are the things, just think for a second, then I'll tell you what Ira says. Because everybody says, I want to go like that. Oh, yeah? Do you know what sudden death does to the rest of the family? Excuse me, gang. Pediatrician, adolescents, suicide, accident, don't go there. Okay? But if you had a short chance now to think, okay, you pray about it and the two of you hold on to each other. And you. So you think of that. And Ira says, these are the things that at the end are very clear. I love you. Say it to whoever needs to hear it. I forgive you. Do you forgive me? Thank you. And if you have had an argument with that pesky middle brother in your family 2 years ago at a barbecue in Rawdon, the big family blowout, and you haven't spoken a single solitary word to the guy in 2 years, he stomped out you. Hell, you. And you know now it's days to weeks, weeks to months. The ministry of healing and reconciliation is the ministry of Jesus Christ. Clearly, not only asking, receiving forgiveness, thanks, gratitude, love. There's no time like the present, as my good Irish mother would say. You got to do it now. And you pick up that phone tomorrow morning and you say, Even if your brother is a pain in the you-know-what organ. Look, Sammy, I am really sorry. We got to get together. This is, and you maybe have to pull out the, I think I'm dying, Sam. I do not want to leave this earth without our reconciliation. So begin to think then that in fact these were the these were the ways that we were thinking for years as we've developed all these new medical technologies. But then in the 1990s, we began to see sweeping Europe and North America a movement. Originally in Europe, it was the legalization of medically assisted suicide. So medically assisted suicide, the doctor writes, you make a request, I judge you competent, I give you a prescription, you then go take the prescription or not. The doctor's not there when it happens. And that began to move rapidly. In Canada, I was involved directly with the CCCV in all kinds of efforts against medically assisted death. But in Canada, in February 2016, the Supreme Court of Canada decriminalized, this is a new acronym, medically assisted death. Because medically assisted death is both medically assisted suicide and physician or nurse performed euthanasia. You ask me, I judge you competent, we're going to do it at 2 o'clock, I come at 2 o'clock, still want to do it, and I inject you. And I have to stand there until I pronounce you dead. That's a physician, clinician performed, because nurses can do it. Death, right? And the most important thing, I think, for us as Christians is that the Supreme Court decision had nothing to do with terminal illness or dying. It had to do with suffering. Get very, very clear. The language of dying or terminal illness is not in the Supreme Court decision. But enduring suffering is. But it can be for an illness, disease, or disability. Acute blindness from an accident. You're not terminally ill. Certainly serious. And you can be suffering if you're a 32-year-old dad with an acute episode of condition of blindness. But this is about suffering. So for us, as we prepare for medically assisted dying and its challenges to the Christian spiritual and moral worldview, let's be very, very clear that now, this is 2016. This is 2019. We now have Bill C-14 legalized this. So we now have years worth of practice across this company. In fact, I will tell you as a physician, it has disturbed me enormously how rapidly my colleagues in medicine have accepted medically assisted death as normal. In fact, there's a huge big problem now with even trying to get them to report it or to double check on the capacity assessment for protection of the vulnerable. So the reasons people request medically assisted death, feelings of loss of dignity, dependence, loss of control, guilt at being a burden to others, isolation and loneliness, uncertainty regarding future care needs, hopelessness and loss of meaning. Can you begin to see the spiritual, pastoral implications for our parish communities in this day and age, when everybody else believes in a technological solution? Community in the usual sense, the way it was in downtown Truro ain't the way it is anymore. I'm not saying that there aren't good people, but the source of community and community beliefs has changed. So clearly for us, as we go through issues we have to take into account for medically assisted, for medical decisions, one of the most important things is we have to differentiate between pain and suffering. Pain, medicine can do something about. Suffering, heartache, I ain't got no prescription for that. There's no injection for the heartache you feel because of the loss of your beloved second son to drugs and prostitution in Vancouver. Is that suffering? You bet it is. Is that far more common than suffering at end of life? Yeah, it actually is. So, what we now know is that it has always been Catholic teaching And this is Benedict's version of this in 2008. Need for preparing for death and dying. Human life, however, despite medical advances, has intrinsic limitations, and sooner or later it ends in death. This is an experience to which each human being is called, and one for which he or she must be prepared. So we're suggesting that in this day and age, where the cultural beliefs are so different, but where there's a lot of Catholic confusion in the midst of all of this, that we need to find a way to help people prepare for decision-making in this new environment where they will be pressured, guaranteed, they will be pressured, if vulnerable, to have medically assisted death. I mean, pressured in strange... A nurse described to me 3 or 4 weeks ago being in anguish over the fact that a younger son whom this elderly mother loved had gone in to visit, and he said, "You know, Mom, you don't have to suffer this." She's a devout Catholic. She's trying the best she can to deal with this. He said, "You don't have to. You've always got the option now. We could arrange for you to have medically assisted death." Now already she's feeling guilt. And is this supporting her in her life journey? So we have some serious conversations. So, advanced care planning is a device that's used in general medicine, though very rarely. We got a huge problem in medicine. We're not doing this for people in the secular world, but I'm proposing that we need to up our ante in the Catholic Christian world. So it has three components: clarifying values and hopes for care, when you lack capacity, conversations with family, friends, healthcare providers regarding those values, and the appointment, completion of an advanced directive where you appoint a substitute decision maker. That there's a new urgency in for us to think about advanced care planning in light of faith, precisely because all of the things we've just described. Jesus' witness to suffering is, in fact, really where we have to begin and end. This is Jesus in Gethsemane. Don't you? The first chapter of my Rediscovering the Art of Dying, the most powerful story in all of Scripture for me. Always has been. Don't know why. And then the cure of the woman with the hemorrhage, and all the girls in the room know why. But Jesus, pay attention to this. It is our firm belief that it is not as if we had a high priest who was incapable of feeling our weakness with us. But we have one who has been tempted in every way that we are, though he is without sin. Let's be really clear here. Jesus doesn't have a little God suit that he zips on to go through difficult times, whether temptations in the desert after he fasts, or his journey to crucifixion before Pilate, being taunted. He didn't have his little home protective, so. Oh, yeah, but he's God, so. If we really believe in the incarnation, Jesus is experiencing. And can you imagine if you and I feel abandoned and confused when we're dying? Jesus, who thought he knew what the Father was asking of him, and is now seeing something different. Whoa. So Jesus' witness is there. And then let me just show you a couple of quotes that I think are important. We're almost ready to have a little break. And hey, St. Blaise is working. This is from the Catechism. Life and physical health are precious gifts entrusted to us by God. We must take reasonable care of them, taking into account the needs of others and the common good. Sorry, let me make sure I read that correctly. Life and physical health are precious gifts entrusted to us by God. Okay, that's right, huh? So we have serious duties at least for the gift. We must take... What's that word there?
Reasonable.
What is it?
Reasonable.
We must take reasonable care of them. I can tell you, I could have earned millions if I were a dishonest nun. Is that an oxymoron? If I asked a random group of Catholics your age anywhere in Canada and the United States, do we have an obligation and duty to do everything to prolong life? Or do we have an obligation to take reasonable care of our life? And we did odds, you know how the biddies... Ask the question, what would we have understood the criteria to be? Church criteria to be? Do everything to prolong biological life. That's not church... Let me finish, okay, because I really... That's not church teaching. This is the next item in the catechism, and this is why. If morality requires respect for the life of the body, which it absolutely does, it does not make it an absolute value. There's a quote, it's actually Pius XII, and I keep wanting to try to find it that far back. Belief that everything should be done for this individual patient in this individual medical facility, everything technological at all cost, is heretical. It's a heresy of the body. The absolute value is not biologic life, it's union with God. It's union with God. So life and health are precious, but it's a reasonable obligation. So some of this teaching, as early as St. John Paul II, to forego extraordinary or disproportionate means, that was the language we used about 20 years ago, up until more recently, to refuse treatment, is not the equivalent of suicide or euthanasia. It expresses the human condition, especially in the face of death. And this is a big one, because you see, some of the people who are confused about Catholic teaching think it's either we have to do all, we have to suffer up everything, or I'm going to take control and end my life, not knowing how helpful church teaching actually is. The use of painkillers to alleviate the sufferings of the dying, even at the risk of shortening their days, which, by the way, when properly done, the titration of opioids does not cause death. Because it's titrated. It's titrated. You develop a chemical kind of response to them when done properly. Even the catechism is saying, pain management is important. I actually think pain management is a moral responsibility to help manage people's pain and other physical suffering so that we can let them attend to their last things. Let you answer those questions and help you do that when you have to work through it. And then palliative care, I've already expressed my frustration. Even some Catholics have not... Palliative care, this is Holy Father Francis, it's an expression of the proper human attitude of taking care of one another, especially of those who suffer. This is not, shifting to the goals of palliative care is not abandoning life and health, it's recognizing limitation and the need now to prioritize pain control and the spiritual goods. And then Benedict, this is a recent iteration of what's again and again and again in church teaching, clearly euthanasia is a false solution. So when we're talking now about this document, begin to recognize these things, because I don't know whose family this is, but you could put up yours, whatever the last family reunion picture you had, right? You put up your folk. And it's clear that what we call intimate others, remember I said I don't use family anymore, but family is clearly, when they're there, thank God they're there. But they actually do all kinds of things in terms of supporting you. What did we say earlier? One of the things you don't want is to be facing serious illness and dying unaccompanied. You need, this is a time when you need all the friends you can get, right? But one of the specific things that you will be requesting in advanced care planning is that if you cannot decide, remember the imagine situations? Who would you choose to appoint to speak for you? And remember this, they will not speak for you because you're a little confused today. We do that with the elderly all the time. Okay, anybody here who deals with long-term care, and I now live in the Sisters of Charity Retirement Center. At 75, I'm one of the youngest. What we see is the patient must lack capacity, and the substitute decision understands the medical situation and choice. And this is the third important criteria. The decision ought to be made as the patient would want, but taking into account the particular circumstances. So we write this stuff out, and I appoint Eleanor McDougall to have my proxy. I appoint her by name, and thank God you got. I'm so sad I can't stay this afternoon for the lawyer. I wanted to hear her. The important thing is you name it. You can give general direction. You can give general direction. But in actual fact, when Eleanor's standing there at 3:00 in the morning in the Halifax infirmary, and she's saying, "No, I know Nuala said that, but I don't think she meant it exactly in this circumstance." Because it is in this circumstance. Let me just give you one example, and then we'll all take a little stretch. Had a circumstance, real life one, where called to the emergency department for an ethics at the infirmary to give some ethical advice, because there was an advance directive that had been prepared, not a faith-based one, but a legitimate secular one. But the person didn't appoint a proxy. They did the old form, which we can't do anymore, thank God, called a living will. Some of you may have done this, right? If I called it one from column A, one from column B. If this happens to me, don't do that. If that happens to me, do this. If this happens, don't do that. It's called an instructional directive. It's not worked paper it's printed on. Because I assure you, and every person who in the room, all the nurses in the room, you shout, "Yay, Nuala," if I'm right. You hand a doctor a situation, and there's one thing that's not covered, and he's going to ignore the whole thing. Happens all the time. So we actually believe in faith that trusting and sharing others to assist us in the decisions is important. But think of the magnitude of the challenge, especially for those of you who are older or middle-aged, where you have children and grandchildren who are not only clueless about church teaching or your teaching or your values, but some of them will be absolutely opposed. There's another whole side of this, and Father Darius and Ellen and I have talked a little bit about this, which is the consequences of the disruption across families when persons have medically assisted death and all members of the family were not in agreement. It can leave the family fractured forever. It can be very, very difficult. So, what I want you to do, get that out of the way. I've gone on longer than usual because I realized Father gave me an extra 10 minutes. I wanted to get in all of the teaching. So I am recognizing that right now, that's a lot of stuff. Right? What we're going to do, let's have a break now. Ellie, you adjust the time when I break now. A little extra time for that. Begin to talk about this or reflect on it. Some of you may actually need to walk outside, get your own head clear. Okay. Then when we come on back, Eleanor, when should we come back? Sorry, Father.
How long of a break do you want?
Well, I want us to be able to have...
Where are you going now? Small group? Or are you
doing... No. I need 15 minutes to go through the questions, and I only need 15 minutes, and then you're going into small groups in the second session. And then we're just going to have a general. You're going to begin to see... Does any, when you ask, look at the little workbook, does it make sense or not?
15 minutes.
15 minutes, so that is?
20 past.
Sister says, get back in your seat. Good morning.
Father?
Yes. Thank you so much. Renaissance. Hard work behind you.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah.
Clearly, there are a few boys and girls in the room who never listened to Sister.
I never listened to anybody, Sister. You need to have a bell.
You need a bell.
What's this guy's name here?
Ron.
Did Sister ask you to take your seat? If you had been listening, Ron, would you have heard Sister say, take your seat? Ron, I saw you just ask the question, is that a challenge? I saw you just ask her, is that a challenge? Okay, wait. Think carefully. Remember, I have a firm belief. Before I die, I'm gonna create some pithy quote that they can use in my canonization. I mean, I've written tons of things. I think, what pithy little quote? You know, yeah. Every after Mass, we have the little sayings. But it is interesting to me. But sometimes it's just you haven't got a clue as to what would be the one thing you want to be remembered for. Some days I think it's got something to do with when you lose your sense of humor as a person of faith. Now, you can tell I'm a super intense person, right? I'm 75. I'm still writing books on the clergy abuse crisis. and end-of-life care and assisted suicide. I mean, that's who I am. But I'm very funny. Ask the sisters at home. And it is my belief that once we lose our sense of humor with each other and in dialogue with community, that that's when some kinds of, it's kind of arrogance or, I don't know what the right word is. God uses a sense of humor to put things in perspective. I mean, I'll just say one other thing. When I was given permission to go to medicine, I'm the only sister of Charity of Halifax as a doctor. They thought I was going to do psychiatry, and then, in fact, early on in medicine, I wanted to be a pediatrician. I wanted to be a baby doctor. Because actually, I love little patients, six and younger. And I've often thought, if I had become a professor of psychiatry, I would be the most pompous twit. Because I'm very smart. I'm super rich. I'm a professor of this and that. But early in my career, you'd be there. Father, pay attention to this. Organized academic medicine on its formal professor rounds can make the bishop's visit to the parish look plain. And the nurses will tell you that. White coat, no cross but the stethoscope, senior resident here, junior resident here, nurse waiting for the doctor. And being a pediatrician, you'd be pomp and circumstancing like a fool, and all of a sudden, Dr. Kenny, I gotta go pee. And I learned very young to say, I'll be right back. That and watching dying children, thank God. But a sense of humor is the other thing. So when I get it done, Ron, I'm going to send the snippet by you to just see, do you think this is a good quote from Sister Newman? So here we're going to do this. I'm just going to outline this. So you know what the little booklet's going to ask you to try and do. And then we will come back. We'll figure out the amount of time we need. Back here we need, I have to be out the door at noon, so back here. I think we probably will give you most time in small group discussion, but I think you do need to be back here for 11:30. So let me set that there. I'll say it to you again. Because that's when we can hear your thoughts and your questions on clarity about what we've proposed. So remember, go back to the imagine questions. Imagine you're perfectly healthy and well, and some acute thing happens. And you're going to be given medical options. So how will you think through those? And how will your spiritual values affect those? And then I'm asking you to imagine that you have a circumstance where you're now unconscious from the accident. And I'm asking you, who is it that you have appointed to be your substitute decision maker for when you cannot decide for yourself? And how have you prepared that? So remember, those are the kind of background things. And we're trying to use this little tool to get you to think and talk through in your own language and your own experience what that might mean. Now, I had a reminder. Who gave the reminder of comfort care? You, good, okay. the expression comfort care, many of you will have heard. In fact, I was remiss, so thanks for reminding me. Comfort care is one of the main goals of palliative care. It's physical comfort, pain, and other symptom control, balance with promoting interaction, prayer, and interaction with loved ones to complete those last things. But they're not separate. They're not separate. And you need to understand, especially in long-term care facilities, people can be perfectly comfortable with having chosen that goal, and then they have an acute event at 2 o'clock in the morning, because I'm now living at care home, you have to see the ambulance go up, and you say, oh, no. I mean, sometimes it's because the wonderful nursing staff there, their LPNs, panicked it. But sometimes a sister's being brought in and out, and they shouldn't be going back anymore. And those of you long-term care, right? So just that language, it becomes important. So these are the kind of questions you're going to look at now for the next little bit. When you reflect on values and belief, what has been your own experience of illness and disability? You do realize this is going to make a big difference, isn't it? You've been healthy and well your whole life. You've been suffering from chronic illness your whole life. You had major traumatic event a number of years ago, and it's affected you. So that's going to be very different than, you know, you're a 72-year-old still running marathons with no major medical history, no bionic bits and pieces, and now you have a decision to make. So in what way has your experience kind of helped you think through both the wonderful benefits of medicine and also the side effects and things they never tell you, huh? The things they never tell you. So what has been your own experience of illness and disability? And how have you responded as you've made decisions in those circumstances? And look at the next one. This is the one that I think, and Eleanor and I have talked about this a lot, is very, very powerful. Has the experience of others' illness, dying, and death influenced your thoughts? And we just had even a small little example of personal tragedy that kind of anticipated death, followed very rapidly by a totally unanticipated. How does one begin to take that into account? So what are the experiences that you've had of others' illness, death, and dying? And I do want you to go back to the language of ancient church teaching in St. Joseph. Can you, when you're fiddling around with your little worksheet, maybe not here today, but maybe tomorrow, when you go home tomorrow afternoon, sit out in the backyard and start playing with these thoughts? Can you describe a good death that you have attended? And what were its features? All right, now I got another one. Have you been at a death that you would have thought was horrid? Horrid, horrible, bad. And what were its features? Because our personal experiences, if we're going to learn from them, we have to reflect on them. And then, you see, I'm asking you, what is your approach to decision-making in general? Factors I've asked you to look at before. Is faith a source of strength and support in illness? It's interesting. I put down there, how do you pray in health crisis? I had forgotten to say to Eleanor, one of the members of our Ministry of Care and Companionship Committee, Eleanor sent me a little commentary on the original, and she did say, she said, you know, I find it's interesting that there are some people who have not prayed for a long time, maybe never. They've said prayers, but they've not prayed. And now they don't know. They don't know how to begin. They don't know what it means to pray. Whereas others, you know, you walk into the room, isn't this great? This is great. You can listen to this. The commonest prayer said in the Christian community since the 13th century. It's not the Our Father. That's the formal prayer heard. Commonest prayer, Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. Why the heck are we so, every single solitary time we say that, we're saying, Mary, pray for me now and at the hour of my death, and 1 hour is going to be the same. And she was there with Joseph, and she was there with Jesus. So begin to think about prayer, and because that's part of, I think, the huge pastoral, spiritual kind of renewal thing that I know Father Darius is working towards. Then communicating values and beliefs. Oh, this is a great one. So I'm the eldest, only daughter in an Irish immigrant Catholic family. Okay. Mom and Dad immigrated separately and met and married in New York in the 1930s. For each and every one of us, we have our own family history and our own family dynamic. How many times do you go to some kind of family reunion and someone will say, do you remember when we were at Harry's and they had the big fight between Jerry and Pete? And then they knocked over the keg of beer, and somebody else is saying, what? I don't remember that at all. It's like, where were you? So when we communicate, we have our own personal way of communicating about spiritual and emotional issues. Begin to think of that. Because you're not going to be her. You're not going to be her. Are there close family members and friends who have drifted from the church? Well, I mean, I don't know any. Remember, I work in the clergy abuse crisis, unfortunately. Unfortunately, this is everybody. But what does this mean? Because they're still going to grieve you, and they're still going to be there. Wanting to be, should be, at the end. So how are we going to communicate? And how do your family dynamics in general address questions? So, for example, many of you know, if you grew up in an Irish Catholic immigrant family, glory be to God, the one topic you never spoke of was sex. Right? I have, first time I was at attending a Greek family whose 9-year-old daughter was dying in the hospital, I came out into the area, the waiting area, the nurse said, Jackie, you got to come out of here. We can't control this family. There were 14 Greek family members wailing. I'm talking wailing. Including the uncle, who was the paterfamilias. Okay, I thought, oh my God, I'll take the, you don't talk about anything Catholic family any day of the week. But I don't mean that. I've learned variety. But your family dynamics are going to be very different. And if they were that way in life, they're going to be that way in difficult decisions. So the question is, who is the most supportive of your deep reflections on care and end-of-life care. Is this person a family member? Is this person a friend? No one can tell you who to appoint as your substitute decision maker. If you've got a loving spouse and they are the most understanding and supportive, thank God and go for it. But I know many people who the last person in the world they would want to appoint is a spouse, even if they had one. And then have you made clear the importance of spiritual care at sacrament sick at a Catholic funeral? And have you in fact discussed within the family these issues of differences regarding belief in medically assisted death and church teaching? Have you completed an advance directive that has all three steps? Do you understand the issue of capacity? Does your substitute decision maker understand their role is not to decide as they would want, but as you would want? And let's finish with this firm belief of mine. I have, thank God, two sisters of charity who have my substitute decision-making capacity. Neither of my brothers has, partly they live in the United States, neither of them has been to church for years. They're my brothers, I love them, but I'm not going to appoint them to this position. They share nothing of my fundamental values. But for the persons who do this for you, your son, your grandniece, a friend from the Legion, whoever it is, they're giving us a great, great gift by being willing to try as best they can to speak for us as we would want. That's part of being the body of Christ. Okay? If one member suffers, all suffer. We are connected in these times. So supporting your substitute decision maker is crucially important. So now you're going to stay in small group until Can we do it 11:20? Because I think then we're going to come back, because by that time, if you have more questions that you've shared and roughed out and differences of what you heard, a little more time. So let's do that. That sound good, Father?
Perfect.
Okay, so we'll do that. 11:20. And then till I run out the door at noon, we're good.
Yes, we will still stay around your tables, and now you can begin your discussions. And then whoever wants to go to pee or have a coffee or anything else, feel free. If not, just discuss those questions that Sister presented to us. So let's start. Okay, folks, I think it's 20 and a half after, so I can see you can discuss for long, so maybe we can continue with the answers.
I was going to show this to him in private, but since he's standing here, I had an email this morning from Archbishop Mancini or something else. I have just said,
I'm fired.
In Truro, lecturing on advanced care planning as a spiritual experience, Father Darius is doing a great job.
I can see it. Probably this is fake news.
I love it. I didn't yet add the sentence about everybody else on his team, but I will. No, I mean, I help out the bishop with lots of things, and he knows every criticism that everybody gives him for everything all the time. So when people are doing a great job in parishes and communities are pulling together and lay people are, I mean, the boss needs to know it. The boss needs to know the good stuff as well, right? We're sometimes very easy for blame and criticism. All right, so now just for my interest, so far with Blaze, don't fail me now. Did any group, because we always know that there are keener groups and slacker groups. I'm going to ask two questions. Did any group get to the third question? Completing an advance directive? All right, okay, so, Father, bad news. You have no keeners in the room. No, actually, I think this is a good sign. You know I'm being facetious right now. Now, how many of you are still on the first question? So remember, the first one was about the beginning of the reflection, right? What questions on your own experience of illness, all of that.
Perhaps what we may ask them to do, they can take this home.
Oh, yes.
And within a few days, they can give you back for your work, and we'll give them a second one for the home. Means they will come back with the answers from home.
Okay, I don't want their answers.
Okay.
You need the answers. Wait a minute. So far we've been in sync. Let's not separate. Okay. Let's not separate now. What I'm trying to get at is from what we saw, and Father and Betty and Eleanor all commented, you seem to have a lot of conversation going on. So what I'm trying to get at is you're not going to do this today. In fact, you're not even going to do this tonight when you go home. And you don't have to do the individual. I mean, I would hope that you take this home, that you individually use it in prayer. I know, Father, and the ministry, I know you folks are going to, you're going to work with this. I know this. This is a big issue, huh? So this is not a test. Sister Nuala was joking about, sister says get back in your seat. But this is not a test that you're graded on. What we were asking for was a sense of, is this helpful? Did this raise for you issues and questions that you either hadn't thought of at all, or you kind of thought of but didn't want to pay attention to because it might be too difficult? Right? So the first thing that I wanted to say was, remember we said, this faith community, you're helping me and our diocese and our local church make this a tool that we think can actually be, keep expanding. For example, we think that the link to spiritual resources, those links need to be even more explicit. And Eleanor reminded me, because of course I keep forgetting that Veritas has a bookstore here, a couple of you heard me talk about rediscovering the art of time. Now I know a number of you have the healthcare decisions, one I did with the Catholic Health Alliance of Canada. But this, and I'm not a shill for this, I have a vow of poverty, Nuala does not earn a penny, a little money to the Sisters of Charity, retirement fund. But this book, The Art of Dying, if you want to sit, and I know nothing anywhere, and I'll tell you about the award that this run won. My good Irish mother would say, Nuala, don't toot your own horn. Thank you, mother. But this has been enormously helpful. It's gone into the third publication with Novalis. Rediscovering the Art of Dying, How Jesus' Experience and Our Own Stories Reveal a New Vision of Compassionate Care. So this won the 2018 Catholic Press Association of the United States and Canada. United States and Canada. Born American, adopted Canadian, I am Canadian. But in the category of pastoral ministry, not bad for a baby doctor. But the thing that I need to, this was the most intense spiritual experience of my life. And I wrote it because I was devastated as a doctor and as a disciple of Jesus Christ, the suffering servant, about the medicalization of assisted death. But it's in Jesus' experience. Remember I talked, imagine Gethsemane to the end. So if you want to find something, it's the most readable thing of its kind anywhere, and it's been acknowledged, as I said, that way. But they have copies of that. So what we're seeing is, as we work through this, you're going to help us identify, maybe these questions are not good enough, but it's not a test. It's as you work them through individually and communally, you begin to identify issues, and then together we're going to accumulate. So that's why, Father, I don't need people's individual. I wouldn't even have the time to do that in the next little while, but we're going to do it together. So the first thing I wanted to know, are we right that we're onto something here, and that it should help two things? One, it should help you with practical decision-making for medical decision-making that you make, whether you're conscious or not. And by this book, it's called Rediscovering the Art of Dying, but it begins with medical decision-making in a retired school principal who has spinal stenosis and back pain. He's not dying, but he had plans for a retirement with his wife to bicycle through France for 3 years. He retires. Not only can he not get on a bike, if you've ever known anyone with spinal stenosis, severe, severe, severe pain, huh? Can barely walk. So that's not dying. But the way we think about decisions from that kind of situation on, all are relevant. So Eleanor's reminding me that they have this here, but I'm saying that this is the kind of thing that when you tell us, for example, that you don't have enough sense of the clear key church teaching, there are a few good resources that we can link to. I'm not making these up, right? When I quote from the catechism, it's the catechism. So you need to tell us the questions work, they don't work, these are the things that are confusing. And I think the bigger thing for the parish, and we were just talking about this at the back, how are you going to use this as a parish tool? Because I will tell you that one of the things, you know, walking around and talking to folks, there are many in this room and others you know who do not have an intimate other that they could choose to decide for them within the faith. So what does that mean for the church community? So first thing we wanted to test out was, do you think this is helpful? You've told us yes. Is this something, can you don't sit down, it's like with this book I've said repeatedly, over the 3 years since I published it. You don't read my book. You pray it. In fact, I've had get emails from people all around the world. And sometimes they start with one chapter. I've got the death of a child. And I talk about spiritual suffering, which is not physical suffering or emotional suffering. Spiritual suffering is when you've lost your faith in God. And I'm a pediatrician. I dealt with death of childhood. This is a real life case I took care of. Super devout young couple, dealt with CCO outreach. Very super conservative from my perspective. Do a novena to St. Anne. When they can't have a baby, they have a baby. They have this gorgeous little baby boy, Sean. Light of their life. The belief is you're good. God blesses you. You're not getting what you want. Pray. God blesses you. They have this little boy at 3 and a half. He wakes up one morning and he's got a little bit of a cold. By 11 o'clock, she calls her mom and she says, I don't think Sean's getting better. Nana says, I've got the car. We're going to IWK. I pronounced him dead at 3:30 that afternoon from meningococcal meningitis. She didn't just lose this incredibly gorgeous little boy. She lost her God. Right? Who's her God? You do good stuff, God blesses you. You do the right thing, God blesses you. You pray hard enough, God blesses you. Well, it isn't that simple. So we now know the exercise itself, we think, has value. This is a very early tool. You know, think of this as a Model T Ford. And we're now going to try to improve it over the next while. So I think that in the next little while, we've got at 10 of, I'm gone to the back door because my driver is getting back to Halifax, as long as St. Blaise keeps working. So in the next 20 minutes, this is for you. I mean, please understand, if you do have a specific question that's really confusing you, you can ask that. But I think that what we want more is a sense of the needs you have in this area. And is this a kind of thing that can begin to help? And what are the other parish activities or resources that might help? And what other parish activities, for example, of visiting those who might be alone and isolated and unaccompanied in their illness. So general observations, general comments. If you really have something, you can't go to sleep tonight unless Sister Nuala tries to clarify it. But in general, this been worthwhile, and where do we need to go? What would make it better? I think those are the questions. Does that sound right? I'm just checking on my team in the back.
And I think it's, in terms of the identification of things and discussions that very practical in terms of how, what to do in terms of different situations, and then the connection at the bottom is what the state said. Mm-hmm. And I think it would be useful for individuals who have not been brought up in the Catholic faith, or did not convert when they were married, to have those ideas communicated. You may, I don't know what, in terms of mixed marriages, you may have someone who is Jewish who is married to a Catholic. And so you've got all sorts of different potential mixed marriages of different faiths. and for those partners who are not of the Catholic faith, it would be useful.
That's brilliant. That's exactly the kind of thing that we need to hear, because that's the kind of, it's not just the dynamic in the family that's unique, but it's also the kind of attention to the fact that we're not kind of, nor will we ever again be cookie cutter, this is what Catholics think. And all Catholic thinks this exactly this way, isn't it? First of all, that was poor theology in the beginning. But it does mean that because we have such an eclectic mix of persons with other faiths and no faiths who have been living in wonderful family life, that now we need to find tools to assist. But I would have to tell you, I know some non-Catholics, non-Catholic Christians in mixed marriage, Christian marriage, who know more than their Catholic partner about church teaching. But I also know that what you're emphasizing is better attention to what might be the tools for information and education that would hit a wider audience. That make sense?
Well, one of the points of discussion that came up was if something happened to my spouse that ended up as a medical catastrophe where she was unconscious, and I'm obviously the one who's supposed to make the first decisions, but Sheila is very close to her family, particularly to her sisters and to her brothers, and there are things about her faith that we just have not discussed.
Mm-hmm.
And so in any sort of discussion or any sort of decision making, I would immediately involve those brothers and sisters, because they would bring a perspective to her faith that is, has not been communicated to me because I don't have all of the shared experiences that she has had.
Perfect. I just want to go back for one. That's a perfect example. The complexity is you begin to think about this. What does it mean to think about your own family dynamic? What are the differences in understanding of faith? How have you shared that? I mean, look, if you've lived together with somebody for 40... Oh, sorry. Once I get close to people, I don't like to... I mean, if you've been married to somebody for 40 years, sometimes I think, well, I'm surprised when people say, yeah, but we really don't talk about faith issues, Nola. Well, what the hell do you... Oh, no. But your point is a serious... I mean, again, whenever I make you laugh, it's because it's a serious thing I want you to pay attention to. We do have different ways, even in our most intimate relations, in what we share and what we don't share. But there's a very, very important thing, because it came up here as well. Let's be very clear. Because you are her legal spouse does not mean you are her substitute decision maker unless she does not appoint one. Can we be very clear about that? The province, state, and ask the lawyer will clarify some of this about, because from province to province it's different, but she appoints the person who will be her substitute decision maker. And you heard me say earlier, for some people it will be a spouse who is the perfect one to do this. But for some it won't be, for complicated, not because they don't like their husband, I mean, it's more complicated about values and sharing. So her task is to reflect on who is the best person for her. But the point you're making that's so crucial, regardless of who gets appointed, you or her older sister, the entire family needs to be sharing in this. The entire family needs to be understanding. It's not just the substitute decision maker that needs to know what you want and how. The whole family needs to enter into that. So crucially important. This is exactly the kind of feedback that we need.
I guess if I was reviewing it, there's
no... Outdoor voice.
I guess I'm reviewing it. Nicely done. Whenever we're facing end of life or life challenges, we go through the grieving, the emotional, trying to find the adjustment, the new normal. And I think it can affect our concentration, our awareness, our ability to focus, all of that. So if there was some reference in here to, it's okay to look at what do you need from an emotional, mental health, psychological, supportive place as you work through this. So if I'm struggling with, I'm making these end-of-life decisions and all of that, and I'm also struggling with acute anxiety or depression or grief, then I need to get support in those areas too. And I just think it would complement the questions and the more practical things you have to discuss.
Because when my husband passed, I had just lost my brother the month before.
Oh, Lord.
And I more or less went through it by myself. And there was no place, like, I know Sylvia had mentioned that after her husband passed, there was a lady that put on a program to help us grieve and, you know, spouses. But there was no place, you know, other than go talk to your priest or no place to go.
Okay, so are we already identifying all kinds of ministerial needs, things that you can help with, that you can help with? So this is very important. And the emotional and the spiritual is important. So one thing that I know, having just had this unexpected recurrence of breast cancer, but having had end-of-life care with kids for 34 years, you're going through grief and loss from the time of a diagnosis. Right? Well, I know all the people who've had major illness because they've just nodded their heads. Okay. The fact that you had the diagnosis, that fact means that you are... we're not sitting here... it's like the folks who emphasize that they won't give anyone medically assisted death unless they're competent are making competence as if it's this... Okay, she knows which day it is. She can add up. She can do that. Is it? And tomorrow I'm going to buy a blue blouse, and then I think next Wednesday we'll go look at the new car. You're not a rational person sitting there making choices, right? Your emotions, your life, your fears, your hopes. That's why it is a deeply spiritual experience, and all spiritual experiences include physical, emotional, and psychological issues. So this is really interesting because we've had four examples now of folks, certainly at a certain age, mine and those around me. We all know people who not only have had, we had one sister in my community, within an 8-month period of time, she lost 3 siblings and 1 niece. She never got over one of them before she was in the midst of trying to grieve another one. And we don't kind of take into account. So some of these are issues that we have to raise. Okay, now I got 3 minutes. Eleanor, if you want to start walking up, you can. Any big thought? So we should keep at this? You commit to help Father Darius? And Eleanor and Betty and Mike and the team here, we're all into this? Okay? And will you let me use?
Yes.
In Winnipeg? And sure. I'm going to go flash in, but this would be perfectly legitimate, quite sedate. I'm going to flash your discussion document to the Catholic Health Association of Manitoba and the Grey Nuns of Manitoba. So. And so we're going to have people learning from each other around the country. So thank you very much. Thank you, St. Blaise, for making me get through this without losing my voice. Please let my driver get me home safely. And I am telling you, If anybody's trying to look for me this afternoon, good luck.
Today is an absolute gift to our parish. Working with Sister Kenny the last, 3, maybe 4 years now, I've learned so much, and the team that she brings around the table for the Archdiocese is just incredible resources. So I am just so grateful, and I know our parish is blessed by having Sister Kenny here. So we have a little gift for you as our way of saying thank you.
I got an hour drive.
I waited until she took a mouthful.
There you go.
And the next time I come, hugs and handshakes are allowed.
Sure. Just 1 second. As you can notice, Sister had water and coffee with Bailey's, so that's why she went through. So not just we will keep pray for you for to St. Blaise, but also to other saints that you will be kept around us for a while, so we can go through this preparation of assisting. So God bless and thank you again.
So we're about 10 minutes ahead of schedule, which is great. Lunch.